Okay. Hey everybody, welcome back from lunch. We have so the order of the afternoon is agenda paper 6 and 7, and then the closed session. So there's quite a lot to cover, particularly in the next session. We've got about 75 minutes, but 11 questions to cover. So I suggest perhaps we hit those sort of intermittently. And if we're not getting around to what you see as the most urgent for your needs, then please direct us. So agenda paper 6 is a market commentary, and I suspect there's going to be a lot of commentary on the commentary. I'm sure there'll be no shortage to hear from the committee. So, Jana, over to you.
Thank you. Well, the good news, it's actually not 11 questions. Some of you may have noticed that number 9 is missing. It's totally intentional. We anticipated that we'll be short of time, so we are saving it for the next session. But we do have 5 very broad topics, so I'll try to keep my introductions to the minimum, and we are hoping to hear as much from you as possible. So just a quick reminder, at our last meeting in November, we discussed the objective for revising management commentary and the principles. Since then, we had our second meeting with our main consultative group, which is called the Management Commentary Consultative Group, not surprisingly. And at that meeting, we discussed our proposals for discussing performance, position, and progress in management commentary. The topics for today's session also are related to that particular discussion. So in one way or another, they're related to discussing performance, position, and progress. So what we would like to start with is the first topic on challenges with current practice on reporting performance and position. We think that it's very important for us to identify those challenges, because these are the issues that the board will be seeking to address in revising the guidance in the practice statement. So on slide 4, we summarize the challenges that we have identified based on our research and based on the feedback from our consultative group. And now we'd like to ask whether you recognize those challenges, whether you have encountered them, and how significant are they for you and for investors in general. And also, if there are any additional challenges, we'd like to hear about that as well.
Okay, so that summarizes the questions that we have on...
That's the questions 1 and 2. That is slide number 5.
Okay, so those are pretty broad, general. Maybe should we pick these off on slide 4 maybe to focus the discussion? Or does anybody have...
I might ask a question just in terms of understanding the kind of scope, because some of the challenges that you've got on slide 4 certainly do recognize them.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering about the scope of this. It's not a standard, this scope of the management commentary, in terms of the entities that I would look at, which tend to be large European financial institutions. So the front half is kind of more regulated, I guess, by the securities regulator in each jurisdiction. So I'm happy to kind of give you some of the challenges that we have with regard to that, but does that help in terms of the management commentary? Because I guess it wouldn't apply to them, these types of entities?
Well, in a way, I think hearing them would be helpful, because we need to produce guidance generally on what investors want to see reported on performance and position. So if there is anything that in your analysis that hinders your analysis in a way, that is what we want to hear about.
Okay. That's helpful.
And it may be a confirmation of the ones that we have identified in our table on slide 4, or it may be something that we are missing at the moment.
Just very quickly, I think it's a really good list. I don't think I can spot anything obvious that's missing. I think you've caught it myself.
The only one thing I'd add is, in addition to sort of neutrality and comparability, is consistency. It sort of falls within the neutrality sort of positive bias point, but just if you're going to talk about something when it's good, you should talk about it when it's not so good in other periods, so just being consistent.
Mm-hmm. And is it the topics that are covered, or is it consistency also between different companies?
I'm talking about like within a company.
Within
for
a company.
Yeah, if you're talking
period.
About a certain metric or a certain area, be consistent, just let them talk about this.
And can I maybe just clarify when you refer to consistency? Because she mentioned, well, if you talked about something good, talk about something bad. So is it more about discussion being balanced and neutral?
I'd say it's more being balanced and neutral over time.
Right.
So if you
right.
talk about something last year, don't take it out next year because it's not good if you know, it's inconsistent
okay.
over time.
Okay.
Osman.
So, yeah, I do think it's a very good list that you've got on slide four. I don't know if others have the same view, but perhaps one thing that isn't on there that sometimes can be problematic or difficult is just understanding the linkages between the disclosures in that front half versus what's in the audited financial statements directly. There's not all, it's definitely got better, but there's not always a clear link in understanding the numbers from front half to the back half directly. It can take a bit of work, or sometimes it just end up having a discussion with management to understand that a bit better. Maybe that's one thing that perhaps is missing from the list.
Jeremy?
Just, I think out of all this list, the one that jumps out for me is the intangibles and this area of revenue investment. So anything in the front half that can help describe maybe some disaggregation of SG&A would be helpful, in particular the areas of not only R&D, but customer acquisition or advertising, just so we can understand how much is maintenance and how much is growth. That would be helpful.
Yeah. Okay, any other thoughts on the list? Okay.
That's very helpful. We'll add some things to our list. So the next topic is this interaction between management commentary and other reports. And this is something that we had in our discussion with the consultative group. We had that there is some duplication between, there can be some duplication of information between management commentary and other reports and financial statements. And there were suggestions that cross-referencing could help with that. But we've also had some concerns about cross-referencing that it may have some negative implications, for example, in terms of audit. So what we are trying to do with our proposals on this is to sort of marry those two parts. On the one hand, we want to promote avoidance of duplication and encourage a coherent narrative and sort of understandable discussion within management commentary. And for that, we've tried to come up with some principles of how cross-referencing can be used and how information can be incorporated from financial statements and from other reports into management commentary so that it is not repeated again. At the same time, we are aware that if you have too many cross-references, this can mean that management commentary becomes fragmented and it's more difficult to understand. So to avoid that, we are also proposing some restrictions on providing cross-referencing. And there was also this idea that sometimes when you include something by cross-reference, you're not quite sure how to treat that information. So for that, we are proposing to include a requirement that the reference information forms part of management commentary, so it would be subject to the same requirements in the practice statement. And all of those proposals are summarized on slides 8 and 9, and we try to give some examples of how we see cross-referencing being used on slide 10. But before we sort of develop our proposals further, we just wanted to hear from you about your experience with cross-referencing. And we would like to ask whether you have come across information encountered this information. Has this been useful or was it problematic? And also, would you agree with the proposals on slides 8 and 9? So these are questions 3 and 4 on page 11.
Maybe no cards are going up. Maybe some clarification on these on A, B, and C. If there's anything whether you want to add to that on slide 8.
So, do you mean about...
Oh, right, you've covered it. Okay. Yeah.
So slide A. So we have three parts to our proposal. The first one is we are basing on qualitative characteristics of useful information. So we are basically saying that what you include in management commentary can either be provided directly or through cross-referencing. But if you include something by cross-referencing, it is subject to the same requirements. So that information has to be relevant. So you cannot just point to very broad reports and say, go and look there. It has to be relevant to a specific discussion. And I think example one is where we tried to show how it is done. So if in financial statements you talk about a breach of material, a breach of some sort of loan agreement, in your management comments you wouldn't just say, oh, loan agreements are discussed in such and such note to financial statements. We would want to say that the breaches are disclosed there, and we would want you to point specifically to a very specific note, and that part of information would be considered to be part of management commentary. And in terms of what you can cross-reference, we are saying that it has to be a report that is issued as a sort of at the same time as the management commentary. It should be available on the same terms as management commentary, and for as long as management commentary is available. And we think that that report cannot be changed after the management commentary has been issued, or there should be a note saying that something has changed.
Okay, Glenn.
Can I just ask, take you back? And I'm sorry, if you've told us the context for this, I've forgotten, which is, we have a template for management commentary in US GAAP, in the 20Ks and the 10K system. In what way are these proposals that you've got here different? Because I find the US system, the US GAAP reporting on management commentary rather good, with all, you know, with the basic idea starting with model description and then the specifics, KPIs, and there is cross-referencing there. Because of course there's a flow, and you know you don't want to interrupt the flow with a lot of detail that clutters the flow. You want the kind of big picture, and then you get directed off to the various specific elements that you need to cover in more detail. In what way are these proposals going to be different from what we see in a 10K or 20K?
Well, I think it is different in a way because we are not providing a template as such. We are not providing a structure for presenting management commentary. We are covering all sorts of different jurisdictions, and different jurisdictions, we acknowledge that people do things differently. What we will do in the RAS practice statement is we will have big content, we call them content elements. So these are the big topics that have to be discussed, and we will talk about business model, strategy, operating environment, risks, and performance position and progress. So these are our big elements. We will give some guidance on what to discuss about each of them, but we will not try to say that these are definitely the things that you have to discuss. Everything in the management commentary should be relevant to that particular entity and should be based on materiality. So in a way, there's...
And have we got... an overview, a template, because you've got the Americans, you've got the document de référence in France, which covers the same ground, really, the model, description, management commentary, etc., which is also a very good system for explaining what goes on there. You wouldn't want to create a third level of management commentary where you're dealing with multinationals who are then producing three different sets of management commentary, because then we'll all have to start reading them all, basically.
Perhaps I'll come in if I may. So I think it comes back to the summary of the issues that we presented with you for the first question on this pack, in that there are some challenges with entities providing the information that we think is useful to you as users. Okay. And a lot of those challenges come down to providing information that is very specific to the circumstances of the entity. we, in undertaking this project, we've looked at a very broad range of national requirements. Some have more consistency than others. So there is an element of needing international consistency, but there is also an element of actually there are some problems in management commentary type reporting at the moment that we don't need addressing. So that's the reason for the project.
Okay. Paul?
I'm a bit wary, I have to say, in this area. I think it is one thing to cross-reference to the financial statement, so, you know, material that is published in the same document alongside the management commentary. I think it's something very different to cross-reference to other publications altogether. And I personally would caution against building that into the model. I think, given, as you say, the aim is that the management commentary is covering the things that are material, drawing in the things that are material from those other publications into that document doesn't add unnecessary discussion and material into the management commentary. It introduces necessary material into the management commentary. And I personally, as a user, would rather have it gathered coherently into one space and one narrative rather than have to go to three or four different documents to try to make sense of something. And I think there's a danger that by allowing, enabling, facilitating cross-referencing to other documents, you actually don't encourage the issuers to actually stick to what's material and really focus down on what matters for the investor.
Okay. Can I just clarify? Would you draw a distinction between information that is filed as part of the year-end process, so things like a governance report, remuneration report, because we do sort of touch on that area, and things that are sort of outside that formal filing process, so things like a sustainability report or even broader?
Yes, I guess I would. I mean, in my mind, and forgive me, I'm sort of a hard copy kind of guy, the annual report includes a whole selection of things, financial statements, this management commentary bit, and the sort of the stuff that sandwiches in between, which is kind of the governance stuff. That I would see as material that's very naturally cross-referenced, because you don't have to do more than flip a couple of pages. If you've got to go to another document or even have another document up on a screen and start cross-referencing that, that feels much more uncomfortable to me.
Thank you.
And is it just a convenience sort of consideration, or is it more encouraging versus discouraging including of material information? I'm just trying to...
Yeah, it's that latter. I mean, clearly there is a matter of convenience, but it's the discipline that it applies to the issuer to actually think through what is the necessary material that we're going to put into the document and really focus it down on the stuff that is material.
I guess the question that comes to mind, that maybe this is for us to think about, is that obviously in various jurisdictions you will have different requirements about what is included in this one single publication called annual report. So as a principle, I don't think it will necessarily work very well. So sometimes that might be part of annual report in the UK, may not be a part of annual report in Russia. So it sounds like your real anchor is about only material information being cross-referenced rather than just a convenience argument. Is this a fair?
I'm not sure that's really the point I'm making. I think the argument from my perspective is, if it matters, stick it in that one document that's the document that, that investors want to pick up and use. Okay. If it doesn't, well, you know, don't bother us with it. And that's the challenge, fundamentally.
Okay.
Yeah, so just to answer your question about the cross-referencing, I think if we talk about internal cross-referencing, so within the same document, there's a couple of things to say. One is, I think that does make sense because it avoids duplication in the same document, but I think there's good cross-referencing and there's poor cross-referencing, and the good cross-referencing has a couple of features which I think, I don't know if it can be worked in or it's too technical or outside the scope of what we're doing, but good cross-referencing, I think, goes to a specific element of what you're talking about. If you're talking about a specific provision, you don't just cross-reference the provisions note and leave people, and there might not be anything there. I think that's one element. So if you don't cross-reference unnecessarily, which we I tend to see quite often. The other aspect, which I think might not be appropriate or practical to incorporate, but some, very few, but some reports that I've seen, if you're increasingly of the person that doesn't print out stuff, I think the good reports that I've seen actually link you there, but also link you back. Mm. So you're not kind of getting lost in an electronic document. And it sounds really minor, but it's actually, when it's done well, it really, really is very helpful. So I think that internal cross-referencing point, I think, yeah, that's fine.
Sorry, to clarify, this internal cross-reference, you mean within management committee or front half, or does this include...
Within the same single document, so the annual report quarterly report.
Which would be... Okay.
So within one place, you're linking back to the financial statements. You would expect the financial statements to refer back to where it's discussed in management committee.
I think the other aspect is with regard to what Paul was saying, and I started to disagree, but then as you explained it, Paul, I really kind of find myself agreeing with you in the sense of cross-references to external documents kind of maybe do take away actually from that materiality point. So it should be a standalone document that is capable of explaining to investors kind of the material issues, concerns, opportunities that is relevant to that institution. So I think I'm quite convinced by that point. I just think that in some cases, and again, going back to the example of banks, you know, we have Pillar 3 reports, which are pretty fundamental. That kind of cross-referencing does make sense to me, but I think the broader point you're making, I do agree with.
Deirdre?
I was going to make the same point as Osman regards to the banking sector as in the Pillar 3 documents, and I'm guessing it applies to other regulated industries as well, that there will be external reports that are relevant and should be cross-referenced to the management commentary. I wonder also, when it comes to cross-referencing, sometimes management have set themselves KPIs, and those KPIs may be a measurement of success that they're perceived in the market. Again, they will say they've done X, and they're sourcing X from such and such a document. If it was more transparent and easier for us, the users, to get access to that document, and that would be useful. And that's obviously an external document to the management report. Now, ironically, when I initially went through these slides and then discussed with some of my colleagues, my impression was that the management commentary that I typically see in the financial sector is quite good, arguably laborious in some instances because it can go on and on and on, but that they tend to hit all the hot spots. Again, it's a very regulated industry, so they're nearly mandated what they have to cover. And it was only when I was discussing with other colleagues, and again, I'm European-based, so even on my colleague who's an Asian financial analyst, he was saying, well, actually, I don't get that level of disclosure or commentary at all when it comes to interpreting the annual accounts. And the key thing that seemed to be missing for most of my colleagues was with regards to this idea that, you know, management of company are stewards of capital, and therefore they need to be encouraged to explain how they are generating returns in each of those business sectors. And by returns, we don't mean margins, we mean income as over balance sheet. And that lack of join the dots back to the cost of capital of running this business and the actual return that they're getting out of it is often missing out of these management commentaries. So that would be our kind of broad overview of the general idea of what these commentaries should address. But as I said, from a European financials perspective, I would say it's very much to the fore, but it seems to be lacking in some other industries.
Okay, thank you. Mariette?
Yeah, I agree very much with Paul, and I just wanted to add that, I've seen a lot of cases where there's just a huge disconnect between operating commentary in some shape or form, like in earnings calls or whatever, and the actual financial statements. And I think the more we tear these two apart, the worse the problem gets. So, for example, management rambling on about, how great the brand awareness is and how much the users all love their product. And then you're like, well, why is it not selling? Oh, because the actual decision makers don't have a budget currently to purchase it. Or, you get them rambling on about their capital allocation policy, and you're like, okay, are you ever going to actually be able to pay for the dividend out of cash flow? How are you going to get out of the hole you've painted yourself into with your balance sheet? So I do think that, and this is kind of what Deirdre touched on as well, I think, that this needs to be sort of all discussed in one go in terms of, how are they generating returns? How is that reflected in the financial? If it's not reflected now, how will it be reflected at some point? What is the reality at this stage? And I also think that obviously, if for legal reasons you need to have a lot of separate documents and there's nothing that can be done about it, but on the whole, as an investor or analyst, I find it preferable to have as few documents as possible and to be really clear, which document I need to read cover to cover to make sure that I've overlooked nothing. And it is a big problem at the moment that, you have all these capital market days where you get so much more interesting information, a lot of which should really go into the management commentary and into the financial statements. And at the moment, it's just not, and you need to go to these separate documents. And sometimes, some really important areas are actually discussed, just in the last Q2 presentation on page 38. And, you need to flip through, dozens and dozens of documents and presentations to make sure that you've really not overlooked anything important that could potentially make you look stupid. And I just wanted to also flag that, this year, for the first time, Novartis managed to actually publish one single document that contains both an annual report, according to EU Swiss legislation, and the 20F that they need to file in the US. So they used to have to file two documents, and they managed to condense it into one, and it just really shows that it can be done and that that should be the direction going forward.
Okay, thank you. Paolo?
Yeah, a couple of comments. First, I assume you have done so, but in any case, it's useful to have a look at the EU directive because there is a reference there to cross-referencing. They kind of created an incentive for that. So it's we'll have to, to stick to that in a way or another. Second point, in relation to internal cross-referencing, as it's being defined here and well-defined, the point is that it must be something good cross-reference. The whole thing that see the general part and special part, to see the general, and you actually don't know what you're being cross-referenced to, is usually a problem. With respect to external cross-referencing, two issues there. One, some of you may remember the old system of AFSB, FASB. Where you got lost from directive here, and then you went to an exception, then to a third document, then to a fourth document. And at the end of the day, you had been cross-referenced 10 or 15 times the different documents. And you got lost. And it's just, does this apply or not? Because you had the exception to the exception, which would be applicable except in a certain case. Where am I? The problem of seeing this, can't help. As a lawyer, the problem is that the moment you cross-reference something, actually you are in a way representing the whole stuff. You cannot say that's, look, just look at table 4 of this document, which I'm sending you to that. So the idea of doing external cross-references is tricky from a legal perspective. for the management? Because you were saying that everything, I'm responsible for everything that's here, and also for a couple of reports from the government, and that actually cross-reference to something else. At a certain point in time, U.S. lawyers would tell you, okay, refer to that, but don't use the hyperlink. Never use a hyperlink, or else the whole stuff will be part of your prospectus. So how to do this external cross-referencing without create this maze of references, and how to deal with the legal issues related to external cross-reference is a delicate problem.
And I was just about to refer to hyperlinking, so maybe I'll Glenn?
Mine was done.
Is there any other comments? Seems like there's some modest amount of resistance to the cross-referencing. For me, I think I land somewhere in the middle, but, you know, to Paul's point, if it's material, I want reference. So in the case of a covenant, I don't want to have to go to a document to find out what that covenant is. It's like we're down to 25% room on our covenant. You know, you need to see it there, what it is, what the number is. But I wouldn't actually mind. I would like a hyperlink to that, if it's public, that the loan documentation. As far as the sustainability report, which is another example, again, that carve-out of that sustainability report that's material to that, to the assessment of, say, some PP&E or whatever, I want to see that specific provision. But also, I would like a hyperlink to the document itself, so that I can see the materiality, the specifics around the materiality within the document, but I have the option to go further. I think we can use technology as a way to sort of address both. I think as far as America is concerned, in terms of the effectively a link to an external document makes this document a part of the document you're reading. I think it's, you know, such a litigious, you know, reading. I mean, it's to me a bit overly conservative, but it seems to be perfectly applicable to create the link. You can always just put a disclaimer out.
I'm not against the
links. No, I know.
But the problem is that you can do it without taking care, because you are actually incorporated in many cases more than you actually want.
And Mitch is quite right that it's perfectly valid to facilitate going and looking for more information in an area that a particular user is interested in, but the point of drawing in the stuff that is material actually into the one place is key.
Okay, we've got Anne. Sorry, I didn't see you. Please.
I just want to ask the group whether they saw potential for the cross-referencing to help with the business of getting the front end and the notes more aligned, and whether people are already doing that. And so that's within the documents, so we haven't got the risks and problems we're referring to. But it would seem to me there's potential that we can cross-reference better from the front half back into the notes, and well, both ways.
I'll just jump in right there that, yes, internal cross-referencing is immensely helpful and efficient to jump down. I personally use it all the time. And what others think?
Agreed.
Yeah.
I'm finding that it's not the norm in my sector. Mm-hmm. The MDNA is quite often totally divorced from the financial statements. Maybe Deirdre doesn't agree, but I find it complete duality between them almost, and I think these proposals are pretty good within a document. I think it's what's being outlined here on the staff approach would certainly help what I look at in the bank sector.
I don't think that cross-referencing automatically creates any sort of intellectual linkage between two things, and I mean, this is kind of what I alluded to earlier. What I'm concerned about is that, you know, yeah, they send you to some part of the financial statements, but, you know, there's no sort of, there's a disconnect between what they've been discussing and what they're linking you to. And what they're linking you to, I'm able to find anyway. So, I mean, they can talk about capital allocation, and then I can go back and look at the balance sheet and whatever and see what I think about it. But, you know, what I would want to hear from them is really how they expect to continue to pay their dividend when they've pretty much run out of equity. And I think they need to be forced to sort of, like, address that right at that place. And then, I mean, unless it's, you know, the sort of example that Mitch mentioned with, you know, documents that might be interesting but might be quite difficult to find. I mean, if it's just, you know, if they're just kind of sending you to run-of-the-mill P&L and balance sheet stuff and run-of-the-mill notes, you know, I can look for those myself. I think the cross-referencing actually makes the document bigger and harder to read in a lot of ways.
Jeremy.
Just as well as kind of how to link or what to link, I think the most important thing to me is a coherence of story from the values of the company, the strategy, the KPIs, APMs, and then into the financial information at the back. So I think there should be emphasis on trying to, maybe that's not the best description, define those blocks and then encourage referencing between those blocks, however it's done, because that's the thing, the value added. So by the time you get to the financial statements, ideally there shouldn't be so many surprises. If you come to surprise in the notes, there's probably something missing in the front end.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, that's helpful. We'll try to deal with that. The next section is the one where we propose that management commentary should include an overview of most important aspects of the entity's performance and position. And we think that would be helpful for users in understanding how management sees their business and what they consider to be important. And the consultative group was largely supported about these proposals, and they also thought that we shouldn't be very prescriptive about what should be in that overview of performance and position. So we'd like to hear your thoughts about that, where you would find an overview helpful. And we would like to also ask you whether any specific matters need to be covered in such overview.
Can I ask one clarification on that before we get? It seems we get quite a lot of overview on performance. Is it inconsistent? Is it lacking? Is it? I mean, it seems to me that seems a very basic.
At the moment, the practice statement itself does not require such an overview, and that's why we think it would be helpful to have some sort of guidance there. So we see that it is happening in practice, but the document itself that we have at the moment, the practice statement, doesn't require such an overview. So we think that including something might be helpful, especially if you think something specific should be covered in that.
So what is the practice statement kind of mission at the moment, if it's not this?
Well, the overview that we mean is a very high-level overview, and then you have a discussion. Well, it can be the main key performance indicators, let's say, that are in that overview, and then you would have a wider discussion of issues. So it's this very high-level overview that we mean.
What was your question more about the practice statement itself?
Yeah, as of today,
yeah,
kind of the scope is whatever it is, but what's its kind of mission? What's it aiming to do if it's not providing an overview of performance and position, I would have thought. So I'm trying to understand whether I've misunderstood the question, because I'm trying to understand why it's not in there now.
Yeah.
I go back to, I think Jeremy made the comment when we're talking about referencing, about building up the story in the context of the entity's strategy, and that's really the sort of way we're expecting that the practice statement will work. So there can be some detailed aspects of performance to understand along the way in understanding whether it's delivering on its strategy. But at the end of the day, you also want those sort of pure headline measures, you know, things like maybe return on capital employed, earnings per share trends. And they're typically the things that appear on the inside cover of an annual report or in the chief executive's statement. So that's the sort of distinction we have here.
But I think you're right. It is largely there today. And in some respects, we're bringing the document up to date,
yep,
to right, make it, to make sure that is a best practice,
okay,
document. And I think really the question is particularly are the specifics that are missing that we should capture within our new document.
That potentially triggers another very long discussion because, the number of earnings that I've seen or read that started off with, it was a great quarter this quarter, and it was an absolute horrific quarter. You know, we've delivered against our expectations, and it was an absolute mess. So I think you can legislate for that or emphasize that, but, you're still going to get the same kind of sort of earnings management, is it, to be cynical. I think, unless I'm missing the point, I think if there's an objective way to force management to say it, that's also, the challenge there is like, okay, we measure ourselves against these KPIs. They were bad, so we've introduced a new set of KPIs this quarter.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, and in retrospect, you've seen the IFRS statements that have just been just very, very sort of the numbers and basic, but no sort of description. But that speaks to, I think, sort of governance and how well we as investors are saying I'm not going to buy your bonds until you start doing calls or start being honest. I'm not going to. So I think the effort is noble for sure, but you're going to run into, again, being sort of cynic, run into management who's going to be like, it was a great quarter. Whenever the pre-open that's down 15% on a great quarter. Just some initial thoughts there. Marietta, sorry, it's your card.
I think, and this is probably kind of speaks to what Mitch has just been saying, what is really missing is the starting point of any analysis, really, which is, market and competitive context. A lot of times companies just discuss their results in isolation and say, well, yeah, we think this is brilliant, this product is growing. Okay, yeah, but it's growing below market. And you basically have to do all of that analysis yourself at the moment, which is okay for an analyst. But I think if you're an investor trying to get a feel for, is this company even interesting for me, you would want to know, in the various segments where they're competing, what number are they in the actual markets? And, is that sustainable or, are they basically subscale or whatever? In terms of market share, are they gaining or losing? What's driving that? And what are they doing about it if they're losing? And I think that's sort of like factual information that they can't really fudge very much either. You shouldn't have to find that out the hard way by dissecting a lot of competitors' reports that might be outlined in a different way that, actually it looks like they're losing share, and wait until you get to ask the question in the call. So I would really recommend that should sort of like be in that high level overview of performance and position, is to really say, okay, this is our position in the market and this is our share and roughly, and this is why we're gaining or losing.
Okay. It's okay.
Yeah, in a couple of sentences here on the same keynote of Mitch's commentaries, it might be useful to have a look at an old document prepared by the SEC some 10, 15 years ago named Plain English, because, legal documents and prospectuses were so convoluted and so confused that they decided to prepare a long document in terms of, how information should be provided so that could be understood. It's a very interesting document.
Thank you. Awesome.
So just on the specific questions about the overview of the performance position, yes, I think it's clear that we thought it, or I certainly thought it was kind of implicit or already in there. I think on the specific points you've got on slide 13 about the proposals, the kind of A, B, and C, you've answered some of them in 14, but just to emphasize, I think where you do have performance measures that management consider important, yes, definitely disclose that, but I think if they change or if management changes the performance measures, explain why exactly, and also explain, if possible, I don't know if it's practical or not, but maybe for that particular period, just provide the old measure as well. And, going forward, you may not, but explain why you've changed it and the rationale for it. And similar for the APMs, I think you'd address it a little bit in slide 14, where you kind of say, maybe not in the overview, but APM should be reconciled to the financial statements. I don't know whether that should be in the overview, but it certainly should be in the management commentary.
Okay, thank you.
you. Yeah.
Paul? I strongly endorse what Osminster said and also what Marietta said. I thought Marietta was going to come back to the Capital Markets Day point again, and I think that is a point that's really worth mentioning here. You know, if the company has disclosed matters to the market in other contexts, there should be a presumption that there is a disclosure of those same sort of data points, those same areas in the annual report as well. And you know, that doesn't mean it's compulsory, but they need a good reason why they're not disclosing it. But.
Okay, Terence?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on Osman's point, just on the performance measures and APMs, not just talking about why you're using one or why you've introduced a new one, but also why you're no longer using an old one or why you're no longer talking about an old one that you took before. So it comes back to the consistency and neutral point of view, just not being able to pick and choose which ones you want to talk about in each period.
I think that was kind of behind my suggestion of saying if you change it, just disclose the old one last time. Mm-hmm.
But so not just if you change it, but if you're not talking about a previous one that you still may measure, but you're focusing on particular another one instead.
I agree. Yeah.
I may sort of counter a little bit the point that Paul made on the Capital Markets Day or these investor days, is that these companies will almost universally, if they're having something like that, all those documents will be available on the website. They'll, if it's in the U.S., they'll file it with the SEC. They're doing everything they can to make them public. If we see much of this sort of sometimes very light, shall we say, strategic focus, broad contours of where the business is heading, you know, often combined with material changes to financial policy, thrown into an annual report, then we're going to run again into this risk of it becoming a document that's just, you know, a bit bloated, I think. Mm-hmm. So personally, I'm comfortable with sort of Capital Markets Days and these kind of, it's just, you know, they're available.
I agree with that. I think you get it, you know, there's not only one document and there's dialogue. I mean, half the things we're talking about here, you can get by asking a question and you get an answer. And you can't have a document which anticipates every possible question that anyone could ask, because it would be a very big document to do that. And sometimes you want a company to talk about a particular division or a particular issue in a level of detail they may cover once in 2 years or once a quarter, and it covers the subject. You wouldn't want that to be in every annual report if it's on the website and you can access.
Everyone has access to management in the way perhaps people around this table.
No, but it should be on. That's why it should be on the website. The transcripts should be on the website. You should be able to get the transcripts.
And in investor relations context, this kind of access. And then again, it gets into that point that I was talking before about governance and transparency and risk premium that you want to pay for not having that information available.
Otherwise, the whole concept of accounting standards will fall apart, because we'll try and do too much.
I agree.
And everyone will end up in a great big argument about what exactly we have to do to get everything done, and we'll never get anything done. It's much better to do something that is smaller, that everyone can agree on, than to get ambitious and cover the whole waterfront and find that nobody agrees on the waterfront. Because at least you have a little core that everyone can proceed on, you have a common standard, and then you move forward. And there's a whole bunch of other things that go on alongside it, whether it's Capital Markets Day or alternative financial measures or management talking about their business, etc. And that dialogue is part of the capital market. That's kind of how we all operate, isn't it?
So could I just ask them, would sort of consideration of capital markets presentations be the right sort of level between what you were suggesting, Paul, which I think was more a sort of much, much closer following of things that have been reported?
I think I used the word presumption that it should be included. Okay. And I certainly, it's not my view that it should be required. I mean, let's remember this is a best practice guidance anyway at the best of times. So, you know, nothing that is in this standard is required of anybody.
you know, I think I would stick to the view that it should be a presumption that materials and performance metrics that have been talked about in capital markets days are disclosed on an ongoing basis in the annual report. But, you know, as with any presumption, it can be rebuttable.
We can just cross-reference them. Little accounting joke. Glenn, is your card still up? Did you want to
move it? Nope, I did it. Sorry.
Does that sort of address the sort of desire for us? I mean, I think of course we should ask for companies to, give a summary of the state, the condition of the business. But I don't have high expectations for that ever being anything other than amazing. No, I mean, and that's okay because standards around them should be tight enough to give us numbers to interpret otherwise.
I just wanted to ask clarifying question. What do you, as a team there, view as the disciplining mechanism for all this?
Yeah, great, great question.
Because I understand this is an ambitious project, and we've talked about it before, and at the end of the day, it's going to be a suggestion, it seems, rather than something else. So what will discipline the company?
So I think the disciplining mechanism comes from building up the story from sort of business model strategy progress. So you have the discipline in the sort of more detailed parts of the management commentary. But I agree, we haven't suggested anything in terms of discipline for the overview part of performance.
But I think
because you mentioned, and I find this interesting, you mentioned that you've got a current document, but you see that some companies do better than the current document. I'm wondering, why are some companies doing better than the current document, and then obviously other ones are doing not better than the current document? So there must be a mechanism out there. As you are writing this, are you considering that mechanism?
It's not necessarily doing better than the document. At the moment, the document is written it's a pretty high level, so there is quite a lot of scope for interpreting it. So you can provide either more detail or less detail. And that's why we are working on this project, because we are looking at practice. We are also looking at what national standard setters did, what other standard setters that work in the field did. So basically, we are trying to catch the best practice and somehow include it in our document.
And I think it's also worth noting that the current document is now 9 years old, and it's an area that is developing quite fast. So we pretty much need to sort of, you know, catch up and bring some sort of uniform best practices in a single source. And then also going back to a question about discipline, if I take a step back and not think about an overview, but think about management commentary as a whole, obviously, there is only so much we can do as standard setters, but generally, well, personally, I believe there are two sources of discipline that we can bring in. So first source of discipline would be establishing very clear principles, sort of setting out in the document that the management commentary needs to be balanced, neutral, objective, consistent, all those sort of things. And then in addition to that, where we can support those general principles but specific detail, for example, by saying, well, if you've changed APMs that you disclose this year compared to the last year, if you change the KPIs that you're talking about this year compared to last year, please explain why did you change, why do you think that current year KPIs are appropriate? So it's building in those mechanisms individually in different areas of the document. That's our hope, at least, and our ambition.
It's just the thing I'm thinking about is there's a bit of evidence out there that one of the big drivers of disclosure decisions by companies is what Glenn points out, questions that they're being asked. It's an organic process. So if you go out with KPIs and people say, yeah, but your competitors use another KPI, so why aren't you using that? There's been evidence that shows that companies change their KPIs just to make sure that they cannot anticipate everything, but at least they discipline them into becoming more transparent on certain dimensions.
What will happen with those KPIs is they won't be in the 10K, the annual report anymore, because the requirements around it, they'll appear in the Capital Markets Day or in the earnings report or on earnings calls. But they, if they're not required, then and companies are sort of disclosing them to be sort of more transparent. If they're going to have to justify why they're changing them. And they're just like, oh, I'm not going to bother. I'll just put it in the annual report. I'll put it in the investors will still be able to get it, and I won't have to explain why. You know, probably what's going to happen is the first person on the call is going to be like, can you tell me why you changed your KPIs? Yeah. It happens, Now, that's for larger companies that are public and have, so, you know, maybe different for the companies that are private, maybe high yield, or where there isn't so much that obligation. I think there, once you get into smaller companies, it could be a bigger issue. Okay, anything else on that?
I think we should probably move on.
Yep, we have
and we'll probably take
minutes.
The last two topics together.
Okay.
So the last two topics are forward-looking information management commentary and information about tax and management commentary. And I think in the interest of time, if we go straight to the questions, and I think what we most like to hear is your experience. In terms of forward-looking information, we wanted to know whether you find plans and forecasts included in management commentary useful, whether you use them at all, and if you do use them, then how do you do that? Also, we wanted to know, is there a are the forward-looking information that is currently missing from management commentary that you think would be helpful to you in your analysis? And in terms of tax, there is also a question, what, if anything, you would like to see about tax in management commentary? So if we focus on plans, focus, and tax, that would really help us, because these are quite contentious issues, and we've had a lot of mixed views about that.
There should be no problem in the next 16 minutes. Marietta, do you want to kick off?
I do think that any sort of like really formal guidance that the company has given, and ideally also sort of like, you know, directional outlooks on individual line items and things like that, should be included in the management DNA, because a lot of times guidance is disclosed very sporadically, and then you're not sure, you know, if it's not reiterated next quarter in the earnings presentation, is it still valid or not? And again, it's a situation where you just need to go through a lot of documents to see whether, to make sure you haven't overlooked any of the guidance. So it should be included. But I'm not actually a huge fan of sort of like pushing management to stare too deeply into their crystal ball, because they're not necessarily going to get it right. And as an analyst, you end up having to justify, you know, why you're off from management guidance. I mean, as soon as management gives guidance, even if it's 3 years out, analysts will pretty much try to align their models with that guidance, and you actually lose some of the diversity of opinion in the marketplace. I think what is largely missing is sort of facts about the future that are, or just, you know, yeah, facts that affect the future that are important for your cash flow forecasting. So things like, you know, for example, you can't even, looking at a pharma company's report at the moment, know whether they hold a 100% stake or a much lesser stake of the economics in any one drug. You know, if they're booking 100% of the sales and having payaways flow through the cost of goods line, or, you know, if maybe they're only booking 50% of the sales, and, you know, if there are any sort of true-ups flowing through the P&L. So any sort of, like, you know, actual facts that are known to management that are really material to forecasting should be disclosed. And I think in terms of the tax, I can see it's a very sensitive subject, so I wouldn't want to actually go too deeply into, you know, specific line disclosures line by line or country by country or whatever. But I think it is a fair comment that at the moment, as an analyst, we don't understand tax rates at all, and they kind of vary from year to year, and we have no idea where they're going to be in 5 years' time. So having some sort of understanding, you know, about sort of the geographic mix, and to say, you know, at the moment we're generating about half of our revenue in 40% corporate tax rate countries, and the other half in 20% tax rate countries, and that's getting us to 30%, and then you can sort of like make your own assumptions about the shifting mix. So something
thing that kind of like at least gives you a bit of a directional feel for where the tax rate should be could be going would be good.
Okay, thank you, Terence. So following on from the tax discussion, I'd like to see a lot better discussion on cash tax rates. Mm-hmm. I think disclosure on tax rates generally maybe not great, but cash tax is lacking. I think particularly I want to know when it differs from the P&L, and especially when that's a consistent difference from the P&L tax rate, what's causing that? If it's something like tax deductible goodwill, I want to know what's driving that, and then I want to understand how that's going to trend going forward. Is that gap a sustainable gap, or is it going to close? Because when I'm doing a free cash flow calculation, if that gap is consistent over time, then there may be an argument to reduce my cash tax paid. And then in general, I appreciate to Marietta's point, it's obviously very it's difficult to go into much detail, but I would like to understand more around the sustainability of tax rates in general, particularly where if there's things like incentives or tax breaks and stuff like that, if that's what's driving a particularly low rate versus your geographical weighted rate, I'd like that called out to understand, is that sustainable going forward, or is those breaks going to end in 2-3 years' time, and understand more about the sustainability.
Okay, thank you. James.
Yes. About any guidance on earnings, and I think for most of the banks I look at, you have a quarterly report for the fourth quarter and then an annual one. Things change in between. Like last month was a perfect example. So I find very little relevance to really focus too much on earnings guidance. On the other hand, I totally agree on the tax comments. I think there has to be a lot more detail about how the current dynamics could change. So if you've got years of DTAs, if you have years of losses in America, and you earn money in America, what that will make. Even saying with some conditional statements, not saying our tax rate will be 23% next year. I don't expect that, but I expect to understand the drivers of why it could go up or down from here. That's it.
Just a clarification or comments. Do you agree with Terence on the importance of cash taxes as well?
That is very important for the few non-bank financials I look at. So that makes a hell of a difference there.
Okay, good. Gary?
And just quickly, a couple of anecdotal stories from my former life in taxes. And by the way, I think tax disclosures are grossly inadequate, and I believed that when I was a preparer. So something more in taxes, whether it's the financials, the MD&A, or elsewhere, I think it'd be useful, and I agree, perhaps more focus on the tax turnaround. But there's a sell-side analyst meeting with our CFO one day, and it's a 15-year-old story, and the question was, I can't believe you can't tell me next year's effective tax rate. And the answer was, well, if you can tell me which countries the profits are in, ordinary capital, non-taxable they're in, what tax laws are going to change, what tax audits are going to come through, in which countries we choose or have to do dividends from to, then I can tell you the tax rate. And so that's sort of the storyline you get is taxes are they vary vastly by country. So I think the likely you're going to get is we expect our operational, geographic, and product line mix to remain constant over the next 3 years. Ergo, if you understand the current tax rate, you probably see it there is probably to see it recur. I mean, it's a problem because you're tied to an awful lot of moving parts, none of which you can directly control. Just given a perspective of it, and maybe not looking for an exact number, but to the extent history repeats itself, and you got a 3 or 4 percentage point effective tax rate range, you could probably comment on that, but that might be too wide of a range for practical analytical purposes. So just war story or two from prior life, but those are how the discussions go.
Okay. Paul?
We've talked a lot about tax, and I agree with the comments on tax. I'll just come back to the stuff on the forward-looking thing, and particularly just the comment that you had from one of the members of the other committee about if a company is required to publish forecasts that they've published elsewhere in the annual report, that might discourage them. Well, so be it, frankly. If they're scared off putting a forecast in the annual report, presumably because it's subject to a bit more oversight and checking, that seems like a good thing. Let's not have stuff disclosed elsewhere that is not subject to so much checking. I don't see a downside from that myself.
I would argue that the governance of the annual report is different than the principles that govern the construction and drafting and publication of an annual report are different than investor days, whatever. So I'm still comfortable with that. I think.
But that's exactly my point. That with those greater governance guidelines, if that's what's stopping people publishing a forecast, fine. You know, let's not have the forecasts that aren't subject to that greater due diligence and governance and oversight, because they'll be less valuable.
But I think that what I appreciate about the forecast is that is a measure by which the management team has had, you know, they've had such confidence and believe so much, because they, you know, management is always going to want to under promise and over deliver. If they miss that forecast, then things really are bad. A leverage target several years out, financial policy several years out, is really, really important to me as a sense of sort of, yes, you know, you're moving toward that North Star. So for me, Marietta's point was excellent in terms of just give me the facts in the future and I can back in the rest, the numbers in the rest. But I do like to see sort of some expectations.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. If it's that important, I agree that it is, then isn't Paul's point even more valid in the sense that if they're afraid to put it in something that is subject to a slightly greater level of scrutiny, it's not an audit, but it's some level of consistency checking,
I think
then surely that information isn't worth.
I think that the lawyers are, you know, the accountant, someone's going to be in front of them saying, good God, whatever you do, don't put it in that filing because someone's going to hold us against it, and then we'll never get that information. So I think that there's a place for both. I don't, you know, you're always going to take management's guidance and forecast and financial policy with a bit of expectation that there's going to be some movement, you know. I think they'd worry about their legal ramifications, or someone's going to say, don't do it, and then we'll never see it. This is a thought. On the taxes, taxes confuse me more than anything, but cash taxes every quarter, cash tax forecast, as much cash tax as we can get. Glenn.
So if you start, I just want to stand back for a second and cover some of the things we've covered before in the context of this issue of tax. We know that over the last 20 years, the level of productivity in global industry has been very low. But corporate profits have never been higher. And it hasn't come because of revenue and cost growth. It hasn't come from gross margin. Virtually all the corporate profits that have come through, and therefore the P/E ratios that we're banking on, the cash flow we're coming from, has come from two sources: capital, working capital management, and taxes, and of course leverage. But the three of them I'm talking about where the cash flow, where the revenue. So we know this when we look at the things in an aggregate that. Basically, we see, you know, maybe 1.5%, maybe 1% productivity growth. It used to be at 4-5% in the 60s and 70s, and it's declined to very low levels. And we can't explain the amount of cash flow that we have in the corporates and the level of profits that we have by looking at kind of conventional revenue, you know, gross margin, revenue less costs. But we know where it's come from. I mean, it's not a mystery. It's come from
disaggregating the model, manufacturing businesses, offshoring. But it's not the offshoring per se that's caused the profits. It's they've been able to separate the licenses for the operation from the manufacturing, which has enabled you to put the profits in Bermuda and the Channel Islands, et cetera, which have been shielded from taxes, so that although you have your manufacturing in China or Vietnam or wherever it is, it's actually producing diddly squat in terms of value added. And all the value added is comes through a license. So this kind of structuring has been the driver of profits for the last 20 years. It's really, really, really important. And hardly any of it is in the management commentary. That's what we know it at a gross level. What we can't see it is in the detailed mechanics of companies explaining how they've met the challenge of declining productivity, how they've met the challenge of low capital investment has fallen as well in this whole period, and yet, as I say, the profits have risen. And this shouldn't make any sense, because normally when you take your foot off the capital expenditure accelerator, you should have declining productivity, but you should have also declining returns. And we haven't had that. And the reason for that is because we know the amounts of paid in taxes have fallen, the amount that's paid in working capital has fallen, just-in-time delivery has reduced the amount of commitment to capital that you have to put out there. Obviously, interest rates have fallen. It's all come from the other side of the thing, and that should have been somehow in the management commentary. Now, it may be that we haven't got very much more to go on that front and that this has come to an end and that we're going to have another cycle which takes us all back. But it'd be useful, if we get this project right, to get management to talk about what that means. Because if we run the end of the cycle on interest rates and we run the end of the cycle on reducing corporate tax and we run the end of the cycle on inventory and working capital management, then we should be able to capture some of these ideas in bottom-up analysis and management commentary. And if we could see that coming through, that would be a victory. That would really be a victory, because the last 20 years we've missed the other side of the story, except in aggregate. And I think that's from my 30,000-foot point of view, that's kind of how I see it, that actually, you know, we bought into all these companies that we're buying. You know, P's are very high. We bought into all of this, but we've basically bought the things that have got nothing to do with the things that everybody think are management value added and the KPIs, et cetera, because they don't include all the other things that we normally talk about.
Thanks, Glenn. Good point. Rosemary, I just wanted to check in and see if you had any thoughts before we move on to a couple more questions here and we hit the buzzer at 3 o'clock.
Yeah, thank you. I don't think I have any significantly different thoughts. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit mixed on the forecast. I completely agree with the financials. I just, I think I can't find maybe the wrong part of it. But I guess I'm balanced. I'd like to see that information.
Okay. We're bumping up against the clock, so we'll just finish out with the last four comments. Marietta, Paula, I think you're next. And then,
It's 30 seconds. One, I mean, as Francoise and Bertrand would say in relation to Glenn's comment, it goes, no one wants to explain why you're not paying taxes. The 4 points in terms of objective information that we should try to include. One, tax credits. To what extent you have tax credits that you are treating as an asset or not. Second one, which is kind of national pastime in some countries like Brazil, tax litigation. I mean, you might end up with a huge victory and all of a sudden you discover that you have a huge credit that you're not showing in your balance sheet. Three, in terms of cash, I mean, whether you're actually paying the tax of your next to the bottom line or you have deferred taxes in many cases, I mean, you won't pay those taxes before 10 or 15 years. And the fourth one, the flip side of that, the tax loss carry forwards that you may have that you should show. These are objective information that should be there in some way.
Okay, thanks, Mariela.
Also just following on from Glenn, I think that was a
very important point, and I think, you know, as Glenn alluded to, the pendulum might already be swinging back, because it seems that, you know, for various reputational reasons, companies are less aggressive on tax nowadays. And I actually noticed in my sector that despite the hugely beneficial U.S. tax reform, that actually the tax rates that they're guiding for are creeping up. And if you ask them, all they say is, well, you know, it's at a mixed effect, and we don't really know where we land and so forth. But I think, you know, this could be the start of another 20-year cycle where it's going in the other direction again, and it could potentially become material, and the tax rates in 2025 could be way above, or 2023, even what you have in analyst model. So I think it is important to kind of strike that balance between protecting the company's legitimate interests, but giving analysts enough to kind of get their teeth into it and make an intelligent, educated guess where the tax rates might be going to in the sort of like 20 to 2025 timeframe.
Okay, Bertrand.
Yes, about tax rate. Yes, a better understanding of the tax rate, and also, as we said, a better understanding of the deferred tax, either in the management commentary or in the financial statements, because this is not clear for us.
Okay. So that's consistent, Jeremy.
I think the information, the future effective tax rate is often visible. The question is the sustainability. And realistically, how much we can ask for all the tax structures to be made public, I'm not so certain. But at least if it's a long way away from the a long way from the geographically weighted number, the global rate's around 22%, if it's, you know, low teens or beneath that, there should be some encouragement to explain why.
If it's materially different from some...
I mean, in terms of specifics, if the cash tax was split out relating to the current year period and prior periods and split out by major country, that would be very helpful. But again, I'm not sure how realistic that would be to expect.
There it is again, cash taxes. I believe Deirdre.
I think the tax has obviously been very well covered, but I just wanted to... I'm a little bit confused about the forecasting side of it. I think there's comments suggesting people would be perfectly happy not to receive forecasts if they're not, you know, audit proof. And just from my point of view, you know, when you get a forecast from management, you obviously attach possibly a bag of salt to it, but it does tell you something. And when that changes, albeit 3 months later, 2 months later, it's telling you something again. You'd be foolish to buy a stock speaking from an equity perspective, buy something just based on management's forecast. That's your job and your remit. But to put anything in place that would deter management from speaking freely with respect to their vision of the future, I think we should be careful in that respect.
Okay. Good. Running out of time, do you guys have any final comments before we move on to the next agenda paper?
That's fine. Okay. We've got...
We have a break.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a break now, all right? So we'll... Quarter past three. Come back in 10 minutes time.